cause you're only a man, and a man's got to learn to take it. Try to believe, though the going gets rough, that you gotta hang tough to make it. History repeats itself, try and you succeed. Never doubt that you're the one, and you can have your dream.
Yeet, 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 a yeet, a yay, yay, a yay, yay, a no, yay, a whoa, yay, a Altuve, a move, a cuve,
smoothie,
a smoothie. This is the Cat Figure Podcast, episode 53. I'm Ryan DiPaolo. Yo, who are you?
My name is Tom McLaughlin.
Hi, Tom. So, I was screaming, straight, and I was thinking, they can't have women empires because... empires, because then they'd make the noises that they make when they play tennis. You know how they'll volley and they'll go, ooh!
Strike!
Ooh! Yeah, and then their strike call would be like, nay! Nay! And the player's ears would explode. Yeah, their, like, glasses would crack.
I really like the umpire. Well, I'm saying this sarcastically. I like the umpires who wait a couple seconds just to, like,
make
do
it
the
dramatic.
Strike thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When
yeah,
it's
yeah.
Strike three looking, like, they're just showing up the players.
It's awesome. I mean, it's like, infuriating, but it's awesome when it's, like, against you. Like, fucking called strike three, and they're like, ay!
With the whole wind
up. Yeah, 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 and they go down, like, they crouch low. All right, so this is episode 53. We got exciting stuff to get to. I hope it's exciting. It's a little arrogant for me to say so. It's often when you say, from a high-level perspective, and then you make your point. Maybe arrogant to call it exciting, but I think it will be. So before we get into the Astros and this new gambling pool we're going to start doing that you guys can get into, and the AL MVP... who are some players who wore the number 53, Tom?
So we'll start old school. The best player to ever wear number 53 is Don Drysdale. The
says who?
Starting pitcher of the
Brooklyn
Dodgers
and
LA Dodgers. Says Baseball Reference.
They say this is the best ever?
It's the highest war by a significant amount.
That's what I was asking.
Then we also have Bobby Abreu is the next best. He was definitely a steroid user. Just putting that out there.
No, he's like a bootleg Giambi,
Longest career, Arthur Rhodes, who was a relief pitcher for the Orioles and Mariners back in the 90s and early 2000s. Current day players, we got Melky Cabrera and...
another steroid user.
Zach Britton.
Another steroid user.
And Rich Hill, pre-Long Island Ducks, wore 53.
Huh. All right. So... Tom, there's lots to get into, bro. But I want
chicken butt.
Yeah. I really don't have. I don't know what I was gonna say. The Mr. Met. I posted on CapFigure.com. I was hoping it would take off like a fake news story. That it was really a marketing hoax by Coca-Cola, because the screenshot of the Mr. Met giving the finger has a Coke, a fountain soda Coke drink.
Yep.
That's sweating with refreshment. And the Coca-Cola logo is perfectly aimed at the camera.
Okay.
And so I was hoping my post would take off and people would believe that it was a real news story.
That's plausible? We got to contact the guy who actually posted the video. Maybe he should get a kickback from Coca-Cola.
Wait, what do you mean we got to contact?
We should find the guy who posted that video and see if he got money from Coca-Cola.
Oh, I thought you said we received contact from him.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah, no, dude, it's definitely a scam. Like, definitely Coca-Cola and New Age thing. They should do this. Create a viral controversy that's not really that controversial,
mm-hmm.
and have their product right in the middle of it. It would be genius.
Yeah, we'd start blurring the lines between reality television and real life.
Yo, and it's going to happen, dude.
It is, yeah.
And the Mets would be stoop cheap enough, like, be like, we
yeah,
the
they
money.
Would.
We don't care.
They would definitely do.
We'll
it.
We'll slander our mascot. We're broke. And speaking of Mets brokenness, that Bernie Madoff HBO film that came out recently is like insane.
I gotta watch that. Yeah,
realizing the scope. I mean, again and again, but like to run a giant pyramid scheme, and his kids really didn't know.
Yeah, I'm reading this book right now that actually it goes into like historical disasters, and it goes into the people who like. Wrote warning signs about different events, like people who knew about 9/11 before it was going to happen. And apparently there were like two writers in particular, like very well-known economists who had been saying for years that Bernie Madoff was like a total fraud.
That's interesting. Yeah, they wrote an article. They reference it in the movie about like him being totally full of it and stuff.
Yeah,
it's. I mean, I guess there's always somebody who made every prediction in hindsight. The Phillies are going to win the World Series this year. Just thrown out there, just in case this becomes one of them.
Just in case. Yeah.
But nah, that stuff is crazy. All right. So anyway, so bro, the Houston Astros are really good, right?
No.
And I want to ask you why that is, but first let me tell you. How good. They just won 10 games in a row, and they're, what, they're 46. They've won 11 games in a row, I'm sorry, and they're 42-16. They're 15. 14 games up in the division.
Yeah, 14 games up in the division.
Like, it's insane. It's early June. And to make things even more preposterous, this is a very self-centered point I'm about to make, but to make it even more preposterous, I was prepared to bet under on the Astros wins at 90.5. Do you remember when we were doing our preseason props? And you said, I don't know, bro, I'm going to stay away from that. And you bet the under on the Mariners.
Yeah.
I ended up leaving the Astros and betting the over on the Rangers wins, but we were both pretty wrong, right? I mean, nobody probably would have thought they'd be this good.
Well, yeah, I wanted to stay away from that bet. I thought the Astros were going to win the division, but 90.5 is like, you know, pretty aggressive line. The way they're playing right now, they're on a pace, I think it was to win 115 games. They're on a pace to be the best regular season team in the history of baseball. And it's interesting because, you know, going back even 3 years, there was that Sports Illustrated issue saying, you know, 27 MLB champs. It had George Springer on the cover of it. And this was being predicted. You know, the Astros, they were the first team to go in full-out tank mode, and they were going to leverage analytics in every single way they could, take the human element out of it, of running an organization.
Man, that's not fair, but
that was their philosophy.
Yeah, but taking the human element out, I think you're going to rile up the old idiots who are afraid of sabermetrics. We got to keep that secret that our intent is to keep the human element out of baseball. You can't tell them that.
Okay.
So go on. So they're all stat-focused tanking.
Well, that was, you know, sort of the thesis behind Jeff Luhnow, the GM, was to use data in every way he could to make decisions.
Right.
And that largely succeeded. You've seen sort of a shift this year where they've done a number of things that are sort of conflicting with that original thesis, which is bringing in veterans like Carlos Beltran, Brian McCann, you know, sort of overpaying or bringing in high-priced relief pitchers. Even, you know, that move for Giles was a couple years ago, but they've really put an emphasis on their bullpen, and they've been innovators as well. They have Chris Devinsky, a relief pitcher who is going between 2 and 3 innings per outing every couple of days, which is what we've been talking about for a while. So they, you know, it's sort of everything is just coming together in terms of their original thesis, having outstanding players at the right positions. And I think they're also, statistically, they're outperforming what I think they even should be. Their pace is just crazy at this
right.
point.
I mean, they're probably not the best regular season team in baseball history. But I disagree with you. I don't think that I don't think that because they're overpaying for guys now to make a push when they're finally close to being good means they're bailing on the statistic approach, right?
I'm not saying that they are bailing. I'm saying they are
going away
sort
from
of
it.
Adjusting well, from where they originally were.
Yeah. Well, I would disagree. I think, one, who knows, right? They're obviously trendsetters, so there is no blueprint for what they're doing. They're the first team to really do it. So they sort of set the trend, right? And maybe for all we know, this was part of their plan. And second, the other team that has done this formula recently, obviously, was the Cubs. And they clearly have made bad moves recently, right?
Yeah.
With overpaying Jason Hayward and trading Gleyber Torres for Aroldis Chapman and stuff like that. That stuff they would do over, right?
Yeah.
But they won a World Series, so maybe
different market though too.
What do you mean?
The Cubs, like Chicago.
No,
has
I know what you mean by different market, but what does that matter for the team?
Well, the Cubs have sort of a safety cushion with their checkbooks. Like if the Cubs sign Jason Hayward for $180 million and he doesn't work out, it's not necessarily crippling. The Astros have fewer assets to sort of allocate once they build that team into place. So
I guess so, but that just makes it higher stakes. That doesn't make it less of a bad statistical decision or not, right?
Well, it influences the strategy for sure.
Yeah, but it's still, you would still say though that they're not sticking to some sabermetric approach, right? I mean, I don't know. Whatever. Either way, we both actually, a year ago when they traded for Ken Giles and gave up Vince Velasquez, and then they signed, or did they trade for Carlos Gomez?
They traded
for Carlos Gomez 2 seasons ago.
Domingo Santana, who's the right fielder from the Brewers now, is really good. So they gave up a great player to get him.
And like we said, they gave up Vince Velasquez and Mark Appel to get Ken Giles. And
it's not a bad deal at this point because Velasquez is garbage.
Right.
Yeah.
And Appel hasn't made it to the majors.
No.
But at the time, 2 years ago and before last season, we criticized the Astros, and I would criticize them again in a way for we suspected that what happened was they were bad for 5 years, right? They moved to the AL and they're super horrible. They get to draft all these guys, Bregman and Correa and Altuve or whatever, and then finally get good, and the first glimpse they have of being close to it, they overly go for it, right?
Yep.
And I guess I'm contradicting my previous point that making stupid go for it moves at the end is perhaps part of the plan, but we criticize them for bailing on it, and maybe that's unfair because those moves happen to not work out. And then now they are this year, right, with the McCann and the Beltran move,
right,
which have very similar overtones to the Carlos Gomez and Ken Giles moves, right?
Yeah.
But this year they're happening to work out. But so anyway.
But the other thing I would note, with the difference between those two sets of trades were, one, the capital, which is like, you know, prospects and salary cap space to get those players. It was a bargain. You signed Beltran to a 1-year deal, and they gave the Yankees basically, like, they paid for half of Brian McCann's salary and gave like a token prospect. Gomez and Giles, on the other hand, they traded like really legitimate prospects.
Yeah.
For players who, you know, Gomez was at the time a pretty good player. You know, that's just the difference in those trades to me.
And they agree, I think. The story seemed to be that they sort of learned their lesson, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So, like, the story we're telling and the story that happened is, like, tank, get good with straight-up sabermetrics, and then you have to bail on it at some point and make some now moves. But maybe they went too hard, as we thought. We can both be right that they messed up in those moves without only looking at hindsight,
right,
and be right that now they're making them better, because the story now for the Astros during the season is that they're not going to go for a rental. No matter how good they are, they are not going to give up big prospects for any type of rental anymore. They're not going as crazy, right? It's like they're not going to go for it as much as they had with those. So that's a good point that you're making, and I think they would agree.
Yeah, and that's a good lesson for them, because especially being a small market team,
they learned
those lessons on a lower scale. And, you know, honestly, Giles kind of worked
out for
them.
What do you mean on a lower scale?
So, like, you know, this year in particular, if they were to go make another one of those moves, it could have sort of a bigger impact on them replenishing a farm system down the road.
I
like they were pretty deep.
They only have so many chances to screw up and learn that lesson.
Right, and their system was so deep at the time that losing a couple prospects didn't make as much of a difference as now. Their farm system has thinned out a little bit, and if you're a small market team and your farm system is just completely, you know, dry of talent, you're in a bad position no matter how good you are today.
Okay, right. Okay, I understand what you're saying. But on the field now, why are they so good this year? Last year, they didn't make the playoffs. They started off horribly last year, and then the rest of the way after the first month starting off, I think they were like something like 16-33 or some brutal start. They ended up being good the rest of the way, but it wasn't enough, right? And this is after they made the playoffs in 2015.
Yep.
Had an exciting series with the Royals, right?
And they beat the Yankees in the wild card game.
And then now they now this year they're on pace to be great again, and they still went for it again in the offseason. But what was the story last year? Why were they struggling, and what's better this year?
Right. So exactly as you mentioned, they narrowly missed the playoffs last year, but I consider them a playoff caliber team the past 2 years. So what I did to sort of approach this answer was I took the team stats from the 2015 and 2016 combined and then looked at the 2017 team stats for both batting and pitching and tried to find the differences between the two.
That's fair. You mean because they were essentially equally good in 2015 and 16?
Right.
Minus the horrible first month of last season.
Right. Okay. I just wanted a bigger sample.
Yeah, yeah, that's fair methodology, bro. I trust you.
So on the pitching side, it's, you know, it's fairly obvious. 2015, 2016, they had a 3.82 team ERA. This year, it's 3.43. That's notching off almost 0.4 of a run per game. That's a significant difference.
Who's better?
On an individual level, you have Dallas Keuchel, back to the form he was, you know, early in 2015. He's probably the best starter in the American League at
this
point.
Not just
early
2015. He won the Cy Young all
right.
of 2015.
Right,
and
all of 2015.
Even. Yeah, but he's even better than that, right? He has a .87 ERA. He's murking it.
Yep, and then Lance McCullers has emerged as
as good as we thought he could be, right, so far.
Yeah, he's an ace on at least 15 other MLB staffs
he's
at
great.
This point. And then after that, their starting pitching drops off, but what's really been bolstering them is that bullpen and being innovative. Chris Devinsky is like, I would use the analogy of like a golfer. He's a hybrid club. He comes in when the starters struggle, or he can come in when you have a one-run lead.
Well, that's a pretty sabermetric on the edge of statistics thing.
What, a hybrid club?
Yeah. No, somebody
using
coming
him.
In like that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, I'm just defending them from you saying they're bailing on it.
I'm not saying they're bailing on
it. Yeah, they're just backing down now, but you're allowed to do that. We don't judge on this show.
He has a 13.6 K per nine rate. So he's striking out every other batter. And he pitches multiple innings per outing.
I don't know if your math was right there. K per nine, every other would be... you're right. I'm retarded.
Yeah, there's 27 outs in a
My
game
math
there,
is
bud.
Wrong. All right.
So then also, you know, Ken Giles has been pitching better than he was. And you have a couple of guys out of the bullpen, Tony Sipp, Will Harris, who are contributing as well. So,
and then how about hitting? Why are they better than last year? What's good?
Yeah, the depth at the top of the lineup, you know, Altuve's hitting the same as he was last year, which is phenomenal. Springer and Correa have both gotten a little bit better than they were. They were both great players, but you have people like Marwin Gonzalez, who's got a 180 weighted runs created plus. He's slugging .636. You know, those are both top five statistics in the league. He's their best hitter so far. And he plays a Ben Zobrist type role. So, you know,
but in crappier positions.
Well, he plays first, second, short, left,
he plays
third.
Short?
Yeah, he has shortstop eligibility in fantasy.
Okay, so at least on paper, he plays short. You know what? You know what's crazy about him? His OPS is like 1,077. His ground out to air out is 2.00. Like he's hitting it. He's not hitting fly balls like everybody else. Which is surprising, but he's going to fall off. But yeah, besides
and
that,
then, you know, we mentioned it so many times last year, catcher was a huge hole for the Astros, and Brian McCann's a pretty good replacement.
Yeah, absolutely. Hell yeah. And I wonder how much effect he probably has on the pitching staff.
Absolutely.
Mean, he's like a professional catcher. And when you're trying to throw together Jason Castro, no offense, and Evan Gaddis or whoever last year. You know, Evan Gaddis, it's great. It helps everything. You get him, you get to use Evan Gaddis as like a relief
hitter.
Yeah, relief hitter, and give McCann a break or whatever.
Right, you could bring him in when you need a home run. Yep.
And or you could just use him in left field, whatever. You got options. Same with getting Josh Reddick, so Jake Marcinik becomes like their fourth outfielder, and Josh Reddick's your boy. You like him. He's been decent. We got to move on, but yeah, man, it's like basically it's not as much of an increase as I originally thought, because it stuck out in my head how bad they were at the beginning of last year. But like you said, they were a playoff team basically the last 2 years. This shouldn't be that shocking. They're like an AL version of the Cubs. And so speaking of Correa and Altuve, Mike Trout got hurt, right? He's out for like 6 weeks now.
Maybe even longer,
right? It sucks because, yet again, he's absolutely murking it Trout-like. So who's leader and who do you think will win the AL MVP right now, yo?
Yeah, I think...
It's weird, man.
All signs point to Aaron Judge.
What signs? Tell me all the signs.
Right, so... We're going to look at it, right? We're going to look at who's the best hitter in the league. We'll just look from batting statistics at this point.
Yeah, well, that's not how I judge MVP. Well, you're taking the human element out.
We'll take it one part
at a
time.
I look at base running. I look at defense. I look at clubhouse chemistry. I look at grit. I look at, is the guy a gamer? You're throwing those things out. You're taking the human element out.
Okay. I'll take the human element out, as you say, but we are going to get to defensive statistics and base running as well.
Go, Jerky. I'm kidding.
So weighted runs created plus, we have Mike Trout leading the league at 212. Second is Aaron Judge at 194. Third place is Aaron Hicks, but our next potential MVP candidate is Miguel Sano, all the way down at 169. So we have a 24-point difference, which is a pretty significant increase for Judge over the next possible MVP candidate. I don't consider Sano really an MVP candidate because he obviously is a defensive liability.
But right now, so look, there are two questions you said you wanted to ask here. Is like, one, who's the MVP now? And then two, who do you think will win the MVP? Neither are Aaron Judge, because one, right now, Mike Trout is still the MVP on what he's done so far.
Right.
Because he's only been out for like a week. And two, Correa is going to pass Aaron Judge.
You think
Aaron Judge can stay this good? You think do you honestly predict that he'll stay at the top?
I think his hitting, it's going to regress at some point. But based on what I've seen of him at the plate, it's not going to regress that much.
Because sure. No, that's
He's totally... the weaknesses he had last year, he has totally turned those around, and he literally has the best patience of any player on the Yankees, including veterans who have played for 10 years. I've not seen him chase an off-speed pitch low and in the dirt in over a month.
Well, that's not unfortunately, that's not the criteria for MVP. Chasing a pitch low in the dirt.
Right, but
do
what
you
I'm
think
getting
he's going
at,
to win?
I think he's going to win, yeah.
Yeah, honestly? Okay,
I do,
and you
yeah.
also would vote for him.
I would vote for him.
Because there's separate discussions, too. It's like, what do voters look for? A prediction versus who you think is the best. I think it will be Correa in both ways. He's a shortstop on the best team, and he's having either Altuve or Correa I would put my money on, and they're probably favored right now.
No, I would say if it was right now, I'd say Aaron Judge is by far and away ahead of those. Like, they're also candidates, but...
Well, in reality, I agree with you. But I'm thinking of sports writers' stupidity saying, oh, well, give Aaron Judge Rookie of the Year. This is his first rookie-eligible year? Was he last
yeah,
year?
Yeah, it's his first rookie-eligible year.
So, I think it will... See, I'm...
But that's not a real argument like, the Rookie of the Year, so he can't be MVP.
No, it's not a real argument, but it's a real factor in predicting it betting-wise, no? Like, in what the voters, you don't think?
I don't think
what are the biggest
factors
you think voters choose? Like, would you rather have a good, great first half and then slow down, or would you rather be reverse? Like, I really don't know which does better traditionally.
I would say, you know, the bookends are more important than the middle, like, because you want to be memorable.
Both are playoff teams, and maybe it's a push, like the Yankees effect being in New York and the biggest franchise, maybe a push as compared to the best team in baseball. But both right. have a giant factor. And so would you agree that Correa and Altuve are the next two favorites?
I think, yeah, I think those are the next two favorites. I think also in the discussion, you have to have Chris Sale, especially if the Red Sox are yeah. able to make the playoffs and he stays at the pace he is.
Every game, he's unbelievable. He's going deep. He's giving up no hits, striking. He's unbelievable this year.
And then, you know, a wild card, I would say it's like a 0.1% chance it ends up happening, but Andrew Miller right now is literally putting up like the craziest numbers we've seen out of a relief pitcher. I mean, he doesn't get saves, but he has a 0.33 ERA.
What's the minimum amount of innings if you had an MVP vote that you would want from a pitcher to give them, regardless of their WAR or anything?
Yeah, I would say it's got to be at least 90.
Yeah, I was going to say almost 100, which won't happen anytime soon, but maybe if there's more Divinsky guys, it could happen.
Yes.
I remember this discussion came up last year. I remember with Zach Britton being so good and he had the highest win probability added. I mean, that was as a result of him being in high leverage situations, obviously, late in games, but there were some people making the case for him. So that's interesting. Miguel Sano also can't win because his lips are so shiny in his headshot. He looks like the David Ortiz bobblehead. He puts on too much Vaseline on his lips before his baseball headshot.
You think it's Vaseline?
Cocoa butter. No,
cocoa
that's racist.
Butter?
I'm going to go to hell.
Okay.
Is Miguel Sano Dominican or something, or is he black?
I think he's Dominican.
Oh, I forgot to ask
Miguel.
All right, so what we're going to do now, we got to do something more with the Astros. Then we're going to explain our betting thing. But I forgot to ask you. So Buster Olney, the Baseball Tonight podcast, we're biting off their idea, but they're doing John Sterling calls, home run John Sterling calls. And for those who don't know, he's the corny-ass Yankees radio play-by-play guy who has home run calls like when Didi Gregorius hits a home run, he goes, "Oh, Didi Gregorius, yes, indeedy."
Euphorious.
For Gregorius.
And then the McCann. Oh,
yeah.
Yes, McCann can.
Right, right. And then what was his other one? Oh, Curtis Granderson, the Grandy Man can.
Yeah.
Like all stuff like that. So
if there's like a nursery rhyme song, it's definitely in that. Like, star bright, star light.
Oh, my God.
Starlin hit it with all his might.
I couldn't believe that was really Starlin Castro's home run call.
You knew that was
going to
happen, too.
Yeah, I thought Aaron Judge's is stupid. He said, like, here comes the judge.
Yeah.
That's not a saying. Like
nobody
like,
says that.
Yeah, that's not a saying. You're referring here. It's like saying, here comes the gardener. It's like, where is that a thing? So what
all rise for the judge is a perfect one too.
Yeah, right. Like, I know.
Okay, so Josh Reddick, Josh Reddick, boy, he gave that one a lick.
That's good. Okay, give me next.
Jose Altuve, oh my, what a day.
That would be good. Oh, my, what a day.
Here's another.
I really like that.
Carlos Correa. Oh, boy, what do you say?
It's hard not to do rhymes. I ended up doing rhymes with mine, too, and the Buster Olney ones all are rhymes. But those are good. Are those all you got?
Yeah.
Come on. What's
for
the
now,
one?
No. For now, I'm thinking there's got to be a layup for George Springer. But
George Springer. He's not a N-word. All right, here. All right, here's mine. Those are good, though. I got Jose Altuve. These hoes be groovy.
Oh, John, you're out of control over
Jose,
there.
These hoes be groovy.
Okay.
Whoa, Carlos Correa uses his core to hit a raya.
Oh, my God.
I can't not rhyme. And then, oh, Josh Reddick, his red dick is huge. My God, no, I messed it up. Oh, Josh Reddick. My gosh, his red dick.
Oh, man.
I don't think he really has a red dick. And then I have, oh, Josh Reddick. Gosh, get that ball a medic.
Oh, boy.
And then here's my last one. He's not on the team anymore, but oh, Luis Valbuena. Learn English, you fucking spick. I'm just like, if he has a racist one out of nowhere.
Okay.
No, yours were good. All right, so now we're going to discuss gambling. You know gambling, right? You know about that?
What is it?
All right, so it's when you play, you bet on sports outcomes. So seriously, we've talked, we did an episode about Steve Stevens and sports touters and guys who tell you they can make you money, right? And they're scams. And we're not saying that, right? Here, when we're going to talk about gambling, we're not at all saying that we're no experts or nothing. But we do maybe know a little something. So what we're doing, and you guys can join, anyone can join, it's on covers.com.
We'll tweet out a link to the group.
Yeah, yeah, it's a public group, and what we're going to do is make baseball picks. We're going to do it for the next month. We have the date of the pool set later than that, but we're going to check in where we're at in a month and then see if we'll continue from there. But so what it is it's a hypothetical money. Unfortunately, we all start at zero. We wanted to start at 10,000, and you got to make minimum 3 bets per week, and you need to bet between 100 and 500 units, you know, fake money. And we're going to see who does well, and we're going to test out different strategies, right, with
yeah.
betting. And in this week to week, I guess we could discuss what we're finding and try to maybe use this as some type of guide or see if we can find anything on how to baseball bet.
Yeah, we're just trying to figure out if it is even feasible to put a winning strategy together.
Or not. I think that's even insanely lofty. I think it's like even feasible to deduce any trend at all. Even.
Sure. Yeah,
like,
no, exactly.
If we could even find a 53% something,
yeah.
that would be amazing. I'd be surprised.
Yeah, because my theory on sports betting, and I've told you this a lot of times, is just the VIG itself makes it so difficult to generate any return, because 10% of the money that you put in each time on every bet, you're basically giving up as a fee.
Your theory, that's a little arrogant. I think that's Vegas's theory too, that
okay.
the VIG makes it hard. So what are the ideas you're going to be testing throughout this competition?
Sure. So they go into sort of three buckets. One would be travel and rest. Two would be backup catchers. And then the third one is weather forecasts. So the first one, travel and rest. I'm going to bet against teams that are playing in an early afternoon or day game after a cross-country road trip or a night game the previous day. The second one would be in a lot of the events where a team plays a night game and then a day game the following day, they will use their backup catcher to start in one of those two games. So in those games in particular, I'm going to bet against the team that has their backup catcher in. I think that the impact of a lot, especially the high-end catchers, like when Gary Sanchez or Buster Posey aren't in there, I think the win probability goes down significantly, but I don't think the line is affected as much.
Probably even more so with crappy pitchers who are good defensive, like, staff managers, you know what I mean?
Yep.
That effect could be very big and very hidden, which is what we're looking for, obviously, because
exactly.
anything we're thinking of, maybe probably Vegas thought of or not, right? We're hoping that this is something that isn't fully accounted for in the lines.
I think that there may be something there. So that'll be interesting to see the results of that particular theory. And then the last one, wind and weather, I know is one of the areas a lot of like sports bettors talk about and look at.
Yeah,
and
daily fantasy, that's like you have
huge.
To be a weather expert. Like you've said that, you know, it's so true.
Because if a player misses a game or if you know something about the wind, so pretty much that's going to impact the over-unders. So when the wind is blowing out at greater than 10 miles an hour, I'm going to bet on the over. And
how are you going to be able to find that? Do you know where you can find?
Yeah, there's a lot of sites that have that information.
I guess with
like
Daily Fantasy as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so I mean, that's good. I think that you're going to fail, and so am I, but I think we're both going to win deep down because we'll learn some valuable lesson as if it were a 90s kids movie. I'm going to do very simple. All I'm going to do is on sportsbookspy.com, they have the percentage of wagers online sportsbooks on each side of a game. By the way, I don't know if I already said it. We can only bet over-unders, like the total runs scored in a game, or which team will win, the money line. So for the totals, I'm only going to bet against the public when there's 90% money or more on the over or under. It's almost always over. Almost every time I've seen a 90% right. lopsidedness, it's on the over.
Unless it's like two aces pitching.
Yeah, then it right here and there it will be
like Kershaw
more on the under.
Yeah.
You know, I the few times I've seen it actually this season have been the times Kershaw, Cueto or whatever it's been pretty more even than you would think. It was when there were games like McCullers or somebody who's like having a great season early on against I don't know. I can't think of like, you know, two pitchers who are really good so far.
Yep.
But then you also see the go over. I really don't. I can't find a trend in why people are picking when I see the look at the percentages of 90%. I don't know enough of the factors off the top of my head when I see the list of why people are predicting a game to go over under. But I do know that there are a lot of people with your strategy of betting against teams the day after a night game.
Yeah.
Because the one time early in the season that I told you I was betting on the Nationals and they were at Colorado. And you're like, they played the night before. No way, man. And then I was reading about it. And then I saw that a lot of people agreed with you because of that. I think a lot of people bet that way. That doesn't mean it can't work.
Right.
I also, when I'm thinking about this, I thought of going with the public because I don't think necessarily that the public has to lose all the time. It was a coin flip in my head. Do I want to test going with them or against them? Because all I think that the books need to make it is that 50% of the time you win, 50% of the time you lose. So if the public wins sometimes, they're right. That doesn't really affect their bottom line. That can be the reality, and the Vegas can make money.
Absolutely. And I think that – I don't know if this got cut off, but the major point that I always bring up when you talk about the public is that information – the percentage of people betting on a side or the total amount of money.
Yeah, well, this site is not money. Yeah, this site is just I don't know if you could get money, but this site, sportsbookspy.com, is just the percentage of bets, which is a lot less valuable than, obviously, the amount of total money bet.
Yep.
So that's why I also want the high barrier of 90%, because I would guess that there's not that many schmoes betting online, right? Like, when it's 90%, that has to include some sharp money, too. So that's it. We got to go. But so the other thing I'm going to do is on the money line on, like, who's going to win. Most of my bets are all going to be on the total over-under, just going against 90% of the public or more. And then maybe one out of every five bets I make is going to be sort of using my judgment, but only on underdogs with money lines. Okay. And the last thing I'll say is that I'm sure you're asking yourself, how often does 90% action happen? And it's actually more than you would think on sportsbookspy.com. Obviously, if you look earlier in the day, a lot less of the numbers are in for the night. But today there were four already. On an average day, there's probably only 1 to 3 where there's that much lopsided action. But those are the only bets I'll make. I may not do it every day, but I definitely will do it only when I see 90%. So, yo, tweet at us and join if you want covers.com. What's the Twitter? @CapFigure.